Buddhist Geeks. Seriously Buddhist, seriously geeky. Episode 60, Geeks of the Round Table, TM. The Geeks of the Round Table continued the discussion on the Big Mind process and the criticisms from Zen teacher Brad Warner. The Geeks focus on these criticisms, which include charging for the Dharma, the nature of an authentic transmission, trademarking Dharma practices, ethical issues with marketing the Dharma, and issues of confusing personal psychology with transpersonal states and stages. This is part two of a two-part series. Do you love this show? Support Falling Fruit and advertise your product or service here. For more details, visit fallingfruit.tv/sponsorship.
It makes me think of a Korean Zen master that I've always been interested in. Well, always. For a couple of years now, I've been interested in Chanul. One of my teachers pointed his work out, and he talks about sudden awakening, gradual cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and during his time, there were all these schools that were all about sudden awakening, and then they'd say, that's it. You don't have to do anything else. You're
Sweet.
Done.
Goodbye.
And then they were kind of, they were the mix in many ways,
yeah.
or the mix on in Korean. And, and so he was saying, yeah, you can have these, you have to, in a sense, have a sudden awakening experience before you really know. You have to get a sense of what the fruit is before you can really get on the path, you know?
Totally.
Mm-hmm. And then you do have to follow it up with this gradual cultivation. And then there are other schools he was arguing against that were all about gradual cultivation. He's like, yeah, they're just running around in circles trying to find something that is already there, in a sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's a pretty cool middle path type of teaching. Right. And it seems like, from what I can tell, Genpo is trying to do that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's kind of like falling in love with the person you end up marrying. That you know, if you don't have that period of romance at the beginning with the, with the hot dates and the wildness, then you don't know what you can have in the long term. If you just try to build up slowly, someday we'll fall in love. You know, that's good too, but you got to have both. You got to have the commitment and the passion, or the experience and the discipline. That's nice. What I think, at least.
So I think we've been kind of, you know, supporting Genpo's, you know, practice and what he's doing. So yeah. I thought it'd be useful too to actually take on the perspective of, you know, just being skeptical. Like, oh, well, maybe there is. I mean, let's question it.
Should
let's
we come from the voice of the skeptic, perhaps?
Exactly.
Well, from the voice of Duff, I really love voice dialogue work, and I love what Genpo's doing. Personally, I haven't experience the higher transcendent voices as being useful for me, even though I love the work in general. Yet, as a life coach, I've actually recommended the work to some of my clients who found it incredibly valuable.
Big mind.
Yeah. So the perspective I often take is, you know, hey, it doesn't rock my boat, but it seems to be really effective for some people. So more power to it. You know, I take a sort of a flexible upaya approach that, hey, whatever works, go for it. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work, go find something else.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the teachers we talked to, who I won't mention, they have a firm grounding in tradition, in the Tibetan tradition. And they actually had some really strong critiques of Big Mind and Genpo's approach and had tried it. Although I would say their reaction was so strong that I question, you know, whether or not they'd really tried it with an open mind.
Yeah, yeah.
But that being said, they had some great points about transmission that basically what Genpo's doing is not the same kind of transmission that happens in the Tibetan tradition, that it's much more in a private setting and that it sometimes takes years to build up to that with the teacher, and that she basically brought up this criticism of confusing psychological techniques with contemplative techniques. And I thought that was a good critique. I mean, it made me question the whole thing and bring it back into light and think about it. And that's the thing with, I guess, with the voice dialogue is it was originally intended for working with the psyche at the level of the ego.
It's a Jungian psychoanalytic technique in particular.
Right.
That was developed to work one-on-one with a client.
Right. So so then I think
that it can't be expanded. But
right,
yeah.
Right. So I think the critique of questioning psychology versus, you know, contemplative kind of trans-egoic states and stages, like, I think it's a good one. I don't know what the answer is. And I suspect I suspect they can be integrated, but.
Yeah. What that just brings to mind for me is, again, you know, what's your view of ego? Are you killing ego or are you trying to befriend ego?
Right.
And so I think the big mind process is actually trying to befriend ego in all of its many, many facets, 10,000 facets of the self, the small self, befriending the ego, inviting them all to come along as we ascend into the higher reaches of self, which, you know, could be a causal state experience or a non-dual state experience, but bringing everyone along for the ride and not really, you know, being at war with the self, with the ego, but actually befriending it. And that's why I think he tends to use that process. It kind of befriends the fragmented parts of self that, you know, could potentially get in the way of some kind of realized state experience.
Mm. The tradition and transmission part, I think, is interesting to ponder. I don't know 100% though about what that person was saying, Vince.
I mean, I
get where they're falling. I get what they're saying, I think, about. And I think there's a question about when someone is exposed. That's still a question that's open for me. I know that in the West, though, it definitely changed. I mean, Tibetan Buddhism, which was the example, is that people are pointing out instructions right and left.
Right.
So I don't know that the teachers are doing it. I'm assuming that they're thinking that it's not necessary. That person has to go through all that. I think there's probably some validity to exposing people later and probably has a higher impact on them when they get those kind of instructions.
Right, right.
And I think there's as we were saying, it's good to question something that's happening that's new and that's innovative and changing from tradition. I also think that there's just tons of, I don't know if this is off the topic a little bit from what you were saying, Vince, but there's also lots of just random crazy practices that people do to do point out instructions. I can attest to that. I mean, I've just been given so many transmissions for practices that are just freaking bizarre. I'll just be honest, and they, it doesn't seem like there's this one special way of doing that. I guess that's my point. And so that's maybe in favor of Gimpo's unique pulling a new technique out and trying it. I mean, there's still a question about the psychological and transpersonal or trans egoic piece, but I don't know.
I guess I'm just curious how you guys are using the word transmission, because in terms of the big mind process, I wouldn't necessarily call that transmission.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. That's a whole other question. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the way I've heard the big mind process described, I mean, transmission usually, I mean, Tibetan Buddhism means that there's something really happening from the teacher to you that's non-conceptual, even though they might be using words and pointing, the instructions are pointing out. But at the moment when there's some sort of experience, it's like that's considered a transmission that's happening non-conceptually.
Yeah.
So that's usually how it's used. Okay. I think there's another use of transmission in terms of like passing down instructions and teachings.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, which is a little bit different.
It's like esoteric and
right.
Intimate and private.
And
most cases, the stories seem to be that way where, the teacher will go and whack you on the head and all of a sudden you'll get it.
Right. Transmitted.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the tradition, if you can call it that I'm part of, is transmitted through audio and video cassette.
That's right. Totally different.
You get the hit of big mind when you're listening to Goenka chant
on video.
Yeah. So you're saying basically there's some part of the big mind process that's not necessarily a transmission. It's not like Genpo's himself or whoever's conducting it, because many people
Van Hamilton.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, again, I'm just a lowly Buddhist student, not an authority on anything at all. But the way I see it, I wouldn't call big mind process a transmission. I think it's more Roshi leading you to yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I think is different than transmission.
Right.
It's more of a state access.
Yeah. I really do think it's just a state.
Whether it's ego, whether you're in the ego voices or the trans-egoic, transpersonal voices, it's just go into the state. That's
basically
the
thing
injunction
about big mind is you actually really have to fully give yourself to the process. You can't just half-ass it. It doesn't work. So however much, intention you're putting into the process, I think is equal to the amount that you get back. So
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, having done the process, when I heard the criticisms from that teacher, and I was thinking, well, I mean, from the perspective of that process, she was in some voice that she wasn't willing to get out of.
Yeah.
And that could be the reason from that perspective that she wasn't able to access these other voices.
Yeah.
And so I certainly thought about that. But it's always tricky, looking at things from the perspective of that thing, because it's almost impossible to ever be wrong.
So what do you guys think about the other claims about? I mean, it seems like there's some other pieces from Brad, just to be fair to his perspective, One of them is that big mind costs a lot of money, or that Buddhist teaching, implied in that, seems like Buddhist teaching should be free.
Right.
I know we covered that a little bit on Buddhist Geeks before, and the other bit about Buddhist teacher shouldn't be famous, and it seems like is implied in that as well, although he didn't say that directly. And what about marketing Buddhism? Is it ethical to market Buddhism, or is it unethical to not market Buddhism?
So what was the first question?
I asked too many
questions. Come on, we're simple people here.
First question. Buddhist practice, should it be free?
Should it be free? Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Especially new techniques.
Right. Well, and to be fair to Genpo's process, he does offer a lot of scholarships and things like that.
Scholarships and suggested donation.
Right.
Doesn't necessarily
imply. I don't actually like
to pay.
It was kind of like a duh thing. I was like, how is this different than any other Dharma that I've seen right now in the West?
Yeah. I mean, do you pay to go on retreat?
Yeah.
Most retreats.
Although I would say that I've wanted to go to Genpo's retreats, and it's been about 4 or 5 times more expensive than the ones I tend to go on. So the system is definitely different in terms of the price. But I also have heard from you and from other people that if you really don't have the financial resources, the community is very open.
Yeah, they work with you.
I think the potential, the problem that's added to this is the whole trademarked TM sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying we can debate that, but I actually had a thought about that because obviously that really struck a chord with Brad because his title of the post was Big Mind TM is a big load of horseshit TM.
Right.
But the funny thing is, so TM is a Western way of saying, listen, don't use this name without permission. But is it really any different? Just the Buddhist traditions just don't have TM.
Might as well just call it transmission.
Transmission.
TM.
Right. TM. But I'm saying you can't, for example, the Tibetan tradition, you can't just go around saying, I'm a Nyingma teacher without getting a bunch of shit from that tradition. So everything else is TM'd. For example, lineage holders, you're TM'd.
Well, that's the thing.
So
it's kind of funny because
that's true.
Brad Warner, his teacher said, you can teach. Right. So he is, a trademarked in a sense. I mean, he was given the authority to teach. And he would shoot down anyone who just started teaching and didn't have any authority, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be like, hey, wait a second, that's fishy.
Mm. Yeah.
So it seems like there's some contradiction there with the TM thing.
I don't really know much about it other than it's a process that he invented that he, wants to keep under the umbrella of him and his sangha. And he actually just gave Shiho to Diane Musho Hamilton Sensei, and she was the first big mind lineage holder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lineage in itself, and it's also a process that could, potentially be used by anyone. Like you could go to a big mind retreat or, one day kind of workshop, see the process, and then go out and claim to be a facilitator yourself.
Right, right.
And the danger with that is you actually need to be very in touch with your voices because I've went to the big mind facilitation retreats where I actually, get up in front of the room and facilitated. So knowing how it works in a certain way, you actually have to be able to be in the voice at the same mm-hmm. time as be outside of the voice to be able to work with the room and to be able to, help people out where they're at.
I think it's totally legitimate to have some sort of safeguard around anything that works, even at the psychological level, let alone at the transpersonal level. I mean, there's just so many things that can go wrong when you start getting into voices. People can flip out or do something crazy.
I mean, that's what I was saying. I think what you described, there's a lot of important things that need to be in place for someone to do this.
Yeah.
And that's the protection about that. I think the other piece I think that's no reason to kind of diss this TM thing. I think the other part is it screams of business, and there's a real big problem with Dharma and business and sustainable Dharma centers where people see TM. I mean, I'll be honest, TM doesn't bother me. If I wanted to look at a name and make it prettier, I would take the TM off because, I don't know, it's just aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
But, there's no real problem for me. That's when TM's something. I'm surprised there's not, if everything else in Dharma in the West is TM, whether they show it or not.
Well, generally speaking, there seems just to be big issues with the integration of money and Dharma in general.
Right.
So,
huge issues.
What's going on around that and why?
Because money's evil.
It's an issue we've dealt with here with Buddhist Geeks too, and in that when we moved to this larger Falling Fruit kind of platform immediately because the website was much nicer and there are other things going on and advertisements that immediately we got criticized.
Yeah,
and it was because we're offering something related to Buddhism and at the same time there's money involved.
Yeah,
I just think people like it hidden, really honestly, because so many wisdom totally. Publications, like what?
And I mean, when you buy a book on Dharma, you're contributing to the capitalist pigs.
I mean, it's true. There's just so much around that like is so Dharma business that people have a problem with buying your cushions, you know, buying your Dharma supplies, buying your Dharma books.
The whole notion of right livelihood and, you know, how to work with that.
Right.
And, you know, people need to live.
And honestly, I mean, definitely. And even that being true, it still seems like Gimpo is approaching it the same as every other Dharma teacher I've seen. Like, it doesn't seem to be a difference. There might be a difference a little bit in price for some of the things, obviously.
Sure.
But I've seen plenty of things that cost. Like, I want to go do a dream yoga retreat with Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche. It's going to cost me.
Yeah.
You know, a lot. And he's a traditional teacher.
Yeah. The way I see money in Dharma is money is kind of just energy. And it's an energetic exchange. And so if you don't actually kind of give something over energetically or really plant your spine in something that you're doing, you're not going to receive the fruits of that, you know, without making some kind of offering or gesture. So I see money in the Dharmic world as just an energetic exchange, kind of offering yourself over to something greater than you that you actually are going to receive greater benefit from.
Right. And this is something that Def will be familiar with in that, like, there's plenty of research that says that unless people pay for, say, therapy in some form, even if they paid $1 or for coaching, they actually... they do worse not paying. I mean, literally, it's like showing they could do comparisons.
That was actually my personal experience. I was trying to break into life coaching. I was giving away sessions for free, and then it occurred to me to charge $1. And immediately, people showed up to appointments on time and were much more committed, and they actually gave me more than $1. They were like, oh, well, it's worth a lot more than that. And I didn't ask for any more than $1. I said, $1 is good. And people were giving me 20s.
Just to give some kind of offering or stake, some kind of claim towards something, actually changed the dynamics of the relationship and what you're receiving. I think it's really important.
Yeah. On the other hand, on the high end of coaching, I've done coaching with people who charge $150 an hour. And what happened to me then is I would project greatness onto them because of the high price tag. So there can be a high end that actually hurts the experience. Similarly, I think,
that's true.
In the Buddhist tradition, it may be more like a cult scenario. Like if you dedicate your entire life to something in a way that actually doesn't work well for your life, and you dedicate more than you'd want to, I think it could hurt you.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And there's always the barrier of accessibility. Like
totally.
How cheap does something need to be for certain kinds of people that don't have tons of money to actually have access to it? And it seems like in principle, that's why there's this idea of the Dharma being offered freely and why so many teachers appreciate it.
You had another good question though, Def. What was the, so that was the thing.
Around marketing or promoting Buddhist practice or even new techniques.
Yes. Marketing.
You know, some people seem to think that it's unethical to market a technique as being effective. You know?
This technique sucks. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I wonder if it's unethical to not market Buddhist techniques that are effective.
Going back to the TM thing, I think some listeners might have just thrown up in their mouth when you said market and Buddhism in the same sentence. It's like market Buddhism. Like,
yeah, well, by marketing,
you know?
By marketing, I mean in just a general way, kind of the definition that Seth Godin gives, which is to promote an idea. And we're promoting ideas right now just by talking about them. Every time you say, you know, Vipassana is great, you're marketing. You're marketing the technique of Vipassana.
Mm-hmm.
You're not, even if you're selling somebody on it, even if you don't benefit financially at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of baggage with those words. I mean, I felt that way about marketing until I met you. And, you know, I started being exposed to other marketing books where they actually use different words. And so it's like a little bit of semantics, I think. And then like, oh yeah, well, of course. It's like whenever I recommend anything or say, hey, this is really good, you should try this out. Yeah, it's marketing. And that's it can be a good and healthy thing versus like, you know, thing like marketers are just out to get you. And so like when anything kind of looks explicitly like marketing, like for example, the experience of a Zen master, you know, it speaks a little bit more to marketing. People automatically may have a reaction to say, that's bullshit, you know, because
well, that kind of goes along with the territory of promoting anything or persuading anybody on anything is that it has been so used by ego for selfish purposes that we are rightly skeptical, especially in the United States, where we have a lot of marketing being bombarded with constantly things that are not in our best interest to purchase or consume. You know, pretty much everything that's marketed on television is bad for you.
That's a good point.
So, but as far as Buddhist techniques, I mean, is there any Buddhist technique that's bad for you?
And is there any that's not really marketed anyways? I think you're right. I think the cool question, I think it is ethical to market and it just happens anyways. I think it's just taking on Western forms. That's what I keep thinking now that I'm talking about it more and more. I think there's just Western forms, but Buddhism has been marketed for friggin' ever. Like, you know, like shamatha, do it. It's great for you. It's good. You'll, you know, develop concentration. They just don't put it in the quotes and put it on a card or, you know.
Yeah. If the Dharma wasn't marketed, it wouldn't even have made it to the West.
Right.
You know, we wouldn't even be here right now having this conversation if there wasn't marketing involved. And I don't have a problem with marketing per se. I guess, you know, there comes into questions how something's marketed.
True.
You know, so that kind of brings it more into question. And then there's, you know, the vow. I vow not to be stingy, especially with the Dharma. How do I get it out there? How do I make the seed flourish in the West? Especially right now, it's having such a hard time. I know in Japan, Zen, you know, is facing a certain death of the tradition in a certain way. And and to keep that seed kind of going, it was brought over to the West. And then how to kind of give that to Westerners who culturally are completely opposite of the Japanese in terms of discipline and, you know, self-study.
Right.
David Deida has a book out right now called Instant Enlightenment, Fast, Deep, and Sexy. Talk about marketing the Dharma. It doesn't seem like it's actually a particularly Buddhist book either, like when you read through it. But most people, when they think about selling the Dharma, that's where it goes in their mind. And they're like, okay, well, that seems really over the top. Not only is it enlightenment, it's instant enlightenment, and it's associated with sexuality in a way that may be inappropriate. It has nothing necessarily to do with, say, shamatha or vipassana practice, and may be opposed to it if you take a precept on, for instance, abstaining from sexual misconduct. What do you guys think about associating sexuality with the Dharma and marketing it?
Yeah, I think it might be a little too soon for that if it were ever appropriate. I don't really know. I mean, it's hard to tell, especially with the skillful means part. I mean, kind of that skillful means piece always leaves like every single door open, like no door can be closed, but it might be a little too soon in Buddhism's development in the West to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's healthy to question the authenticity of the marketing being done, which I think is what happened with the Big Mind. That's an example. People are questioning the principles behind it. What I'm interested in is piecing out the shallow criticism or like shallow reasons why someone might call it inauthentic, like just doubt that's not backed by reason, just automatically like, oh, it's Gimpo and, you know, I don't buy it. They don't give, you have to give someone a chance. I think it's totally fair to call into question like, well, is what they're saying, is that appropriate the way that he worded that? Maybe actually, I mean, I'm still debating whether the way that it's worded, that advertisement, it possibly could be worded a little bit better that makes it a little bit more authentic. But there's the issue of like, but does it need to be a little bit flashier to get people to come to it? Yeah. And there's, and then, yeah, one thing, which I'll let you go, but is the bait and switch that I know Vince has talked about. So there may be some stuff going on with that, you know, getting people in and then switch it on them. And
yeah, get them in with the idea of Kensho and Satori and then switch it with some actual...
Ha ha ha, all life is suffering.
Ha ha ha, you have to sit.
Ha ha ha, like you can have a brief glimpse of some freedom from identification, but now it's something that you need to get back to.
Yeah, in some ways, all Buddhist promotion or marketing or techniques is that bait and switch. You know,
yeah, freedom from suffering.
Freedom from suffering. Damn,
that's a huge claim, dude.
Yeah, still haven't had it for a few retreats. Feels pretty. I mean, the techniques are definitely still valuable, and that's the thing. I mean, it's really tricky. It seems to me. I mean, when I really check in with myself, like, because I have been brought to Buddhist practices and literature and Dharma through often flashy things. A lot came from Ken Wilber, who's an expert at being flashy. There's a thick book on philosophy called Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality. There's no reason to put sex in the title at all. It's hardly about sex.
That's a good point. I never thought about that. I just like, that's a good title.
This was a damn good title and sold me. And it's a great book too. Yeah. And I was sold on going on a Vipassana course because of how powerful the experience was for people I know who've gone on many courses. And they told me about the pain. I mean, to be honest.
Yeah.
And that has been a little different than some of this marketing stuff. But I wonder, you know, how much should we, when we're promoting wonderful things, wonderful Dharma, should we say, and it's excruciatingly painful and you should still do it.
Right.
Right.
That's what Vince does.
Yeah. I've shifted again, but for a while there, I wouldn't, if someone was interested in Buddhist practice, I'd be like, yeah, you know, listen to them, not really suggest anything, but just if they really seemed interested, be like, well, I'll give you the fair perspective. One, on the one hand, like, yes, enlightenment's possible. You can do these techniques. They will get you enlightened. And you can't really know what that means until you get there or until you realize what that is. And in the process, like, there are periods of death and dying that happen on many different levels.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly very fun or even useful in the real world. And that sometimes people have deep insights and then they get into a period of death and they actually don't know a way to get out. And I think sometimes that's because they don't have good guidance but oftentimes it's because Buddhism's marketed in such a way that people come to it and they give themselves to it. And then they find themselves in this difficult territory and then don't have the correct guidance I don't know.
That seems the main danger of marketing or promoting Buddhism as freedom from suffering or a way to be happy. It's that it can set you up for not realistically dealing with the stages that can be really painful.
Right.
Or the deep stuff that can come to the surface.
I think that's follow through more than marketing. I mean, and that may be a question of how Western Buddhism is being established. And right now it's pretty loose, you know, whereas I think really in past times, it's been more intimate and you've had more access to the teacher. So I think that's less to do with the marketing versus like having someone there to hold your hand, you know, to the point that you need to. But I think the bait and switch, you know, is unavoidable. And it's because in favor of the gradual path, you have to experience things first before you really get what's coming next. I mean, that's at least been described a lot in Tibetan Buddhism. So for example, going through the yanas, you go to the Hinayana, they tell you this one thing, and then they just say, just kidding, you know, and then they go to Mahayana, and then it's like, and then they go, and then even in Tibetan Buddhism, they'll go one step further, Vajrayana fooled you again, you know, and so you just can't get to those things. And even the five paths are laid out, like, where the first two, you're just conceptually guessing, but they're saying your guessing is pretty close conceptually, and you still won't fully know until you have that direct experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the bait and switch just seems to make sense, that you're kind of getting some idea, and it sounds really good. And you get on there and then they start giving you the insight to what's really going on, you know?
In some ways, life is a bait and switch, though. I mean, here we're all promised great things in every aspect of our lives. And if we believe that too much, then we don't face some of the harsh truths of reality that Buddhist practice is pointing out to us, like impermanence, suffering, and no self. Those things are there whether we take the Buddhist bait and switch and practice or not, and we suffer regardless.
Yeah, I guess in terms of the bait and switch, there's, you know, the intrinsic bait and switch that we're all talking about. And then there's the intention to actually do a bait and switch.
It seems like most teachers don't.
It's not like, hey, to do this. I think it's more of an intrinsic kind of part of the process.
Yeah.
And not really malicious in terms of the intention of actually being cognizant that I'm going to, you know, premeditate this bait and switch on you.
Well, when I was saying bait and switch, it didn't feel like a negative thing to me because actually I think teachers are aware of it consciously. But the part we were saying earlier is the follow through is like when they tell you something, their intention is to be there lovingly with you through that path. So when they say, yeah, come here, like Buddhism is great. You're going to have great experiences. You're going to have less suffering. I mean, they're aware that they're doing that and they're aware that there's more things that are coming that are going to rock your world that you're not aware of right now, but they're going to do it they're there with you the whole time.
Yeah.
So when I say that, I think it's very benevolent.
It's like a long-term relationship.
Yeah.
You know, it's so great. You know, you have all the sex, there's this whole love bliss state and, you know, later down the road, there's a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is.
You know, so it's the same kind of thing in the bait and switch or Buddhist teachers, you know, inviting people to come and, these claims of no suffering or whatever.
When you're saying you earlier before we started recording that you'd like to be closer to your teacher in that community and that there's something nice about being a part of the community. I think maybe just the fact that there are so many teachers teaching in different places and oftentimes we go, you know, like for instance, I go to Massachusetts or to California to go do retreats with teachers and I rarely sit with the same teachers more than once or twice. And I only see them a couple times during the retreats. And so I can see in a lot of traditions where there isn't that kind of constant relationship that
one night stand.
Yeah. Or it's just the way certain of the traditions are structured. For instance, the Goenka tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Duff's never even met Goenka, but he's seen his audio and video tons of times.
Yeah.
And so it's
there are assistant teachers that you can access, but I've actually never contacted them in between courses.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it just goes back to the intimacy thing with what we're doing here in the West. I just don't think we've fully established it yet. And I think there's some practitioners like, I mean, I think Vince, you're a very independent, strong practitioner that you keep following up with things, but you even have a good relationship, like for example, with Daniel Ingram, who you touch base with,
right?
Who help you a lot. And sure. I think there's probably, there's some fear with that may happen with the whole marketing thing and the bait and switch is like, mm-hmm. are you going to be there for me? It's kind of like students going to a large college, you know, the college
mm-hmm.
university
yeah.
might be like, oh, come here. You're going to get a great experience, everything. And you get there and you're just like a cow in the herd and there you have no personal experience.
Student number 5839.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly like that. I mean, I worked at CU before and that's a huge school. And so, you know, there's maybe some experience that people having with that, getting lost in the whole Dharma thing, you know?
Oh. Yeah. And Roshi, you know, is in Salt Lake City and has the Kanzion Zen Center. And I've seen a number of people, you know, do a one-day workshop and then actually come to the center and mm-hmm. hang out there for the week or do mm-hmm. a retreat, either more formal, rigorous Zen retreat or, you know, the Big Mind retreats. And, you know, he's there every single day. Mm-hmm. And so he actually makes himself pretty available
mm-hmm. yeah.
In ways that I haven't seen other teachers do
right.
as much. You know, they have assistant teachers or they have senior students even.
Right,
you know, fulfilling those roles where Roshi actually, you know, is in the Zendo sitting every day, right. you know, wow. with you.
Yeah.
I think that's great. And just hearing that, I'm even more in support of him charging or asking for a high suggested donation. I mean, because if it can support that kind of community, I think that's really powerful. And it takes a lot of money to run a building and run a center and have mm-hmm. an organization. You know, people who are in the Christian tradition end up tithing or donating fair amounts of money, or if they don't, the churches are often in financial peril constantly, even though there's hundreds or thousands of community members. If there's not a financial contribution there, then you can't have a regular minister or a regular Zen teacher who's just hanging out and is available.
Right.
Geeks of the Round Table. The table that's round. There's geeks of the Round Table.